How about now? Uh-oh. Oh, well. Okay, that's what it's all about. So I want to talk about algebraic results that have flowed out of people's focus on algebraic CSP. And one possible algebraic result that would reflect back on CSP, and this would be Bellariot's conjecture, which I'm going to put right here. Let's see. If A is finitely related, this is a finite algebra. And there's two forms, so let's just make it an idempotent algebra. So it's a finitely related idempotent algebra. Then if it has day terms, and you know this just means that the variety generated is Kigerit's modular. Then A is supposed to have a cube term. I'm going to explain what a cube term is at some point, very soon. Now, the first real result that I will put into my talk says that every finite idempotent, every finite algebra that has a cube term is finitely related. By finitely related, I mean that you have the clone of term operations and the dual clone of relations on A, the relations that are admissible for the operations. And finitely related means that the relational clone is finitely generated. It means that taking a finite concatenation product of relations, there is one relation, rho, say, contained in A to the N, such that the clone of term operations of the algebra A is just equal to all the operations that respect rho, okay? So we're going to prove that an algebra with a cube term is finitely related. And this implies in particular that every finite algebra with a Mousin term is finitely related. And this solves an old problem that I may have initially formulated, or at least got interested in the 80s. It was just how many finite algebras are there that have a Mousin term operation. Of course, there are only countably many finite algebras up to isomorphism of finite signature with finitely many operations, because there's lots of operations that where the clone is not finitely generated, but lots of algebras. And there are a continuum of really different algebras on a three-element set. How many of them can have a Mousin operation? And a number of people contributed to exploring that problem and couldn't solve it, got partial results, say, for some classes of groups. I think this is new even for finite groups. Every finite group has a finitely related clone of term operations. There were three authors of the paper where we proved this. I'm just saying it now. I'm going to put it on the board in a few minutes. Erhard Eichinger, Peter Mayer, and me. Peter's here. I don't see Erhard. Okay, that's one result. Now, after we proved this, I got interested in this Bellariot conjecture. A weaker form of the Bellariot conjecture is what was proved by Lieber-Bartow. I think it was mentioned this morning, that every finitely related finite algebra with Yonson operations, where the variety is congruence distributive, actually has a near unanimity operation. Well, that result would actually follow from this, together with something not very hard that Peter Markovic and I proved, which I'm not going to tell you what it was. So that was a special case of this. And that is maybe part of the reason this now seems plausible. what Lieber proved was a Zeidery conjecture, and that seemed to be utterly inaccessible, but it was proved using Prague strategies and as a direct consequence of the focus on CSPs. So, and why would this be nice? Well, this would expand, certainly, the class of algebras for which we know that CSP is tractable. Because it would mean that when you're you're looking at a CSP problem over the finite algebra A, you're only looking at finitely many relations. So really, for the true polymorphisms are the clone of operations that respect those relations. That's a finite related clone. If the algebra is already has day terms, that clone has day terms. And this conjecture would imply that it has a cube term. So we know the problem is tractable. Actually, the Markovic-McKenzie result would what am I trying to say? If the algebra had was actually in a Cargis module array, the cube term and the cube, if it was in a Cargis distributive variety, if you have a cube term and you have Yeltsin terms, then you have a near unanimity. That's what Peter and I proved. Okay, so this is maybe plausible. I'm not willing to wager much money on this turning out to be true, but I have several equivalent forms of this. And in exploring this, I discovered that an idempotent clone, the clone or term operations of the idempotent on a finite algebra, is inherently finitely related. Every larger clone is finitely related if and only if the algebra has a cube term. So this is another striking property, characterization of finite algebras with cube terms. Now, what I just told you seems to work. I can prove it only if the algebra is idempotent. So you need to start with the finite algebra, look at the idempotent reduct, and now we say that thing is inherently finitely related if and only if the algebra has a cube term. And that's the other result I hope to sketch a proof for in this talk. What I did, actually, is finally, at the last minute, I wrote up the talk in 10 pages. It's much too much to give in a talk. It's much too much to give in a 10-page paper, but there's a whole lot of exercises here. I'm asking the reader to prove things that aren't too hard. I give you hints, and I'll do that in the talk. Maybe I'll get through most of it. So I want to start out by explaining, saying something about Taylor operations, Taylor terms and Taylor operations, and the special case is a cube term and a cube operation, and where they came from to begin with. And then some results already known about algebras with cube terms. So Taylor operation n here should be bigger than 1, else the equations I write down will imply that A is a one-element set. Oh, T of Z equals T of W. Z is and W are going to be matrices of X's and Y's. With Y on the main diagonal on the left, and X's and Y's elsewhere, I don't care what, and X on the main diagonal on the right, and I don't care how the X's and Y's are distributed elsewhere. So you read this as saying that you've got some algebra that has two elements, X and Y, and these are n by n matrices, so you've got an n tuple of column vectors and actually a n tuple of row vectors, and you've got some operation T on A, and it's acting in A to the n coordinate wise. So the first coordinate is the first row. So we have a first row equation that says that T of Y blah equals T of X blah, and then T of blah Y blah equals T of blah X blah, and so forth. So but these are supposed to be equations true for every x and y in the algebra. So these equations in particular imply that if T were just the first projection, then you would get x equals y, so the algebra has just one element. So the purpose of a system of Taylor equations, it's actual equations that imply that the operation cannot be a trivial projection. Okay. A Taylor term is a term in the algebraic language for an algebra whose the operation it defines is a Taylor operation. So a Taylor term, we'd have T of Z equals T of W, and and this is an equation, can be regarded as an equation where you just take x and y to be the specific free generators of a free algebra on two generators. This is an equation in the free algebra on x and y raised to the n. And recall that the free algebra on x and y over the variety generated by A can be identified with a certain subalgebra of A raised to the A to the nth power, namely the term operations, right? So all of that will be important. I'm going to give some examples of special systems of equations, special Taylor operations. Some of them are cube operations. The cube operation is a special case. Oh, there's one other thing I forgot to say. We're always assuming the operation is idempotent. So you have two equations, the matrix equation and the equation Tx, Xx equals X. Now, the cube term case is the case where the matrix on the right is all X's, and you have Y's on the diagonal on the left. That's a special cube term. That leaves all kinds of possibilities, and you erase that T. So there's two ways to write a cube term, equations. First of all, I'll talk about a cube operation. So T satisfies the equation TXX equals X, and then T of Z equals T of, this is just X is everywhere, right? And together with that equation, that means this is the column vector of X's. Okay. At the moment, it's square. So the idea, this is one way to approach the idea of a cube operation. It's an operation which is idempotent and satisfies, say it's n-ary, for each I, it satisfies an equation with y in the ith place, x's and y's everywhere else, the result equals x. Okay? Now, there's other ways to write cube equations. So now, if this is a term, of course, we have a cube term. Cube term, T, as evaluated in A, is a cube operation. So let me write this in terms of a term from now on, little t. And I'm just going to write it like this, so we can leave out that equation, because we're saying that t of a bunch of x's and y's is equal to x, whatever an x and y are. So substitute x for y everywhere, and you get this. If this n by n matrix Z has two equal columns, you can remove one, just remove one variable. You get a different operation. Say you substitute this variable for that one. Now you get an operation of one fewer variables. It's still a cube term, okay? So we can, after doing that, we have the same number of rows, but maybe fewer columns. And now we know that all the columns are distinct. So the columns are distinct tuples of x's and y's. And in every column, there's a y. In fact, initially, it was on the main diagonal. And now we can add extra columns for dummy variables and include all possible columns of y's and x's that have at least one y. Now we're getting close to the standard cube term equations. And when you finally write those columns, permute the variables so that, let's do it lexicographically, say, so y is less than x. We're looking at column vectors. So the column that has all y's first would come first, and then, let's see, is that right? Yeah. And then a column that has x and then all y's and so forth. So I guess I can call this a standard cube term equations. Actually, I'm doing it backwards. I want to let x be less than y. I want to write x. This is lexicographic order with x less than y. So at the top, we have x's as much as possible. And the top row, when you write all these columns lexicographically, is a lot of x's and a lot of y's. And the result, of course, is equal to x. How many x's? There are 2 to the n minus 1 y's. N was the number of columns, rows initially, and there are 2 to the n minus 1, take away 1, x's. If we add one more column on the left, it would be all x's, and then we'll have all the 2 to the n columns. So next, lexicographically, you've got some x's, some y's, and then this tuple of y's is replaced by 2 to the n minus 2 x's and 2 to the n minus 2 y's, okay? And here is 2 to the n minus 2 minus 1 x's and 2 to the n minus 2 y's. And you keep on going, and down at the bottom you have x, y squared, y squared. This is 2 y's, x squared, y squared. And at the very bottom you have y, and then x, y forever. And t of each of those rows equals x. These are the standard. If you have a cube term, you have a cube term that satisfies this huge block of n equations in 2 to the n minus 1 variables. We call this an n-dimensional cube term. The dimension is the number of equations. Okay? Now, if you think about it, the Malsev operation requires 2 equations, seemingly. It's actually a 2-dimensional cube term. T of... let's see, how does this work? X, Y, Y is X, and T of Y, Y, X is X, and T of Y, Y, X is X. If you look at the columns, you've got all the 3 columns that have at least one Y. So for examples of Malsev term, NU term, there's one other example I wanted to give while I'm doing it, of a Taylor term, which is not, these are cube terms, but a weak NU, were those equations actually written out? So T of Y, X, 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 X is supposed to be the same as T of X, Y, X, 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 and so forth. So I don't know how many equations we actually need here. Maybe x, x, y, x equals, okay, you tell me. I want an x here, so I'm going to want an x here, so maybe I'll put a y in front, why not? Anyway, you get, all the tuples with one y give you the same result, but it's not necessarily equal to x. So you have to add the equation t of x if x equals x. And while I'm about this, I might as well give some other Taylor terms which are not cube terms. This is weak NU. Here is cyclic. So T of X, X, X is X. I'm not going to write it like a Taylor term. I'm going to tell you that T of X1 to Xn is equal to T of X2 to Xn, X1. So you can permute the variables cyclically. Now, you can write equations at X and Y that are consequences of this and put it in the form of a Taylor term. Obviously, this implies that this guy is not just a function of one of the variables. And finally, a Siggers term. I don't know why I can't resist doing this. It's not supposed to be part of the talk. I'm wasting time. So this is S for Siggers. S, X, X, X equals X. And S of X, Y, Z. Z equals X. S of Y, Z, X, Y. There is a 5 or 6 line proof that every finite algebra with a Taylor term has a Siggers term using the fabulous result that that Bartow, Krosek, and Niven proved about finite graphs, the loop lemma, and applying it to the free algebra on 3 generators over the algebra A. So the result is that every algebra has a finite algebra has a Taylor term, has a Siggers term. Another result that was proved by the methods of developing the theory of absorbing subalgebras that these Libor and Marchand were talking about this morning is that every finite algebra with a Taylor term has a cyclic term for every n, which is a prime number bigger than the size of the algebra. So first result along these lines, Morody and I proved that every $5 with a Taylor term has a weak in U. Okay, that looks pretty weak these days. So all of these are equivalent for any $5 has one of these, one of these, one of these has a Taylor term. But cube term is something else. If you have a cube term, you can use the standard equations to show that you also get day terms just by the appropriate substitution of variables, x, y, z, and u, for all the variables, x1 to x2 to the n minus 1. This was done first by Peter Markovic, as far as I'm aware. So algebras with a cube term are special Kagas-Monson algebras. And in fact, Pavel Izsak invented cube terms. I wanted to say Walter Taylor, I think, invented Taylor terms. That's why we call them Taylor terms. He did it, I think, in the 1970s, and what was it all about? He proved that a finite idempotent algebra has a clone which cannot be mapped homomorphically into the clone of trivial algebras on a two-element set. In other words, the trivial clone, if and only if it has a Taylor term. So this is the necessary sufficient condition, in some sense, to have a non-trivial clone, in that sense. And the idea for cube term, which Pavel invented this thing, was you can immediately show that if you have such an algebra, then there is an integer k, which is closely associated with the n here, such that the number of admissible m area relations is always, over that algebra, is always at most 2 to a constant times 2 to the k. So the log of the number of m area admissible relations is like a polynomial growing like a polynomial. In fact, it's growing almost exactly like a polynomial of a certain degree, and that degree is closely tied to the least n, such that you have an n-ary cyclic cube term. But it took a while to prove the other direction of this, to prove that this thing implies few subpowers. In fact, that was what our long paper with many authors was all about. And the hope was that we could generalize results that were known for two-element algebras, that if you had few subpowers, that this was the right notion of few subpowers. It turned out to be apparently exactly the natural notion, that log of the size of the subalgebra lattice of A to Bn is bounded by a polynomial, that you could get tractable CSP by some generalization of a mouse of operations of cube term, generalization of the Dalmau-Bulyatov algorithms. And that worked out eventually. So you know we have this other large class of algebras that have tractable CSP. So that's cube term. How do you prove that there are only countable in any finite algebras with cube terms? In fact, if finite algebra A has a cube term, then its clone is finitely related. Well, we need a result from that paper with many authors. One of the consequences of having a cube term is the following, and I'd better write it out, that I have to define splittings, or what in our paper were called indexes, so this applies to the situation where we have if you have a cube term, there's not too many subalgebra of A to the N, and every subalgebra of A to the N has a small set of generators. This is what the algorithm lives on, right? If you have a Mousset term, every subalgebra of A to the N has something like a constant. I think it's log to the base 2 of size A times N, no more than that many, a small subset of generators. As a subalgebra, it can be generated by a very small set. So you can actually describe a generating set, small generating set, and that's what this lemma is all about. I should call it a theorem. I'm going to write it down and cover it up for a while. So this is from the paper on finite algebras with few subpowers. But we have to know what an index is. So to talk about indexes, we need to be talking about a power algebra A to the X, and X is linearly ordered and finite. Finite, linearly ordered, by say less or equal, an index in A with respect to X is simply a triple IAB, where I is an element of X, and A and B are elements of A. A witness to this index is a pair of functions, a pair FG in A to the X squared. So they're witnessing the following thing, that you can have a pair of functions that look like this. They agree below I, and at I they take the values AB. So F on less than I equals G on less than I, and F of I, G of I equals AB. Now, if there is a pair FG that witnesses IAB and FG belong to a certain subalgebra or subset S of A to the X, we say that S witnesses that index. And this theorem says the following. Suppose A is it's got to be a finite algebra. It doesn't have to have a doesn't have to be idempotent, but has a k-dimensional cube term. Recall this means that you have k equations. And X is a finite set supplied with a linear order. That's what that says. And R and S are two, I'm going to write them this way, less or equal to A to the X. This, and A is boldface, that means subalgebras. Subalgebras of A to the X, algebras of functions. And R is contained in S. Then it turns out that R equals S, if and only if. First of all, R and S witness exactly the same splitting of indexes, IAB. But there's another condition, that they should look the same on small sets of coordinates. And for any y contained in X with the size of y less or equal to k minus 1, then the projections of R and S into A of the y are equal. Okay? Well, what this means, for instance, if you have S and you find a set P that witnesses all the indices. Now, how many indices are there? Well, the total number of indices is the size of X times the size of A squared. Okay, so you need twice that many, potentially twice that number many functions in S, you put them into your set P, and then you need enough functions in S to project, for every projection of a member of S into one of these small products, you need one function to choose a function that has that projection. So that's going to, Y is just, A is fixed and Y is at most k minus 1, so that's a constant number of functions you have to add. You put all those together, you generate a subalgebra R of S, you're guaranteed R equals S, so that was a generating set. Okay. The way we're going to prove that the clone containing the cube term is finitely related is we're going to show that the clones containing this one satisfy the descending chain condition. So we're going to have a finite algebra A with a cube term. Guess I'll start over here. I am now launched into the proof that every finite algebra with a cube term is finitely related. Uh, So A is finite, not necessarily idempotent, has a cube term. And what we need from that cube term is exactly that theorem. So C is going to be the clone of term operations of A. And C, of course, is a multipartite set. For every n, we have the set of n-ary term operations, which is essentially the free algebra on n generators, right? It's a subalgebra of A to the A to the n. And we're going to assume that we have clones RSC1, C2, and so on, strictly descending and infinite sequence, and they're all greater than C. Now, if C were not finitely related, we know that C is related. It's the opposite of its relational clone. So there's a set of relations, and C is exactly the operations that respect those. There's kind of many relations. You just list them. You let C3 be the set of all operations that respect the first three relations, and C5 those that respect the first five, and you get this. And if C and their intersection is equal to C, if C is not equal to one of them, then you can refine this sequence, and you definitely have a strictly descending sequence of clones, right? In fact, C is going to be inherently finitely related if and only if the lattice of clones above C has the finite chain, has the descending chain condition. So this is what we want to show. This cannot exist. How do we do it? I'll make some definitions. First of all, we're going to need a linear order on A to the n for every n. I'm going to do that by regarding the union of all the A to the n as the algebra of words over alphabet A, okay? Linearly order A, and then lexicographically order A to the n for every n. And I'm not really going to mention, I don't need to refer specifically to that linear order. So you will lex order A to the n with respect to that fixed linear order. Okay, and now I'm going to need a very different partial order on W, which is the union n greater than or equal to 1 of A to the n. This is the free semigroup. This is a strange order. If alpha and beta are in W, I'm going to say that alpha is press equal beta if and only if, first of all, they have the same content, exactly the same letters appearing in alpha and beta. And, well, let's say alpha is A1 to A. K and beta is B1 to BL. So there's got to exist a one-to-one increasing, strictly increasing function pi. This is mapping 1 to K into 1 to L. What I'm trying to say is that alpha occurs as a subsequence of beta with a special property. So that, okay, so B pi I is always equal to AI for I equals 1 to L. The other property is that pi respects first occurrences. I'll just write it out in quotation marks. If I've got an element of A, a letter, C, which first occurs as A3, it's different from A1 and A2, in alpha, then in beta, it will first occur as B sub pi 3. Yes. So beta has to be at least as long as alpha. If they have the same length, they will be equal. And they have the same content. There are only finitely many possible contents. So this Also, it's true that when this happens, it's forced that A1 equals B1, okay? So this is a fairly weak partial order, but it's strong enough because I'm going to claim that this partial order on W, it's a partial order on W, and it's quasi-well ordered. So this is one of the exercises in my talk notes. W under less or equal is, under press equal is quasi-well ordered, and what that means is whenever you have an infinite sequence from W, alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha n, n W, there's got to exist I less than J such that alpha I is press equal alpha J. So there are no, there's no infinite anti-chains in this ordered set, partly ordered set, and there's no infinite descending chains. So this is a variation, a refinement actually, of an old result of Gray and Higgins. This result was first proved by Erhard Eichinger, I believe by himself, although Peter Mayer may have contradicted me, and he did it for algebras having massive operation and every and all the constants. And sometime during the next fall, all three of the co-authors independently, I believe, recognized that yes, indeed, you could get rid of the requirement of constants, and yes, indeed, of course, we can extend to algebras having a cube operation. But we needed to vary the original definition of this order on words. Okay, now we're ready to still have a little time. At least I'll get through one proof. Let's see. So this guy is well quasi-ordered. I'll start with the easy part of this. Here's another exercise. Let's suppose that I've got clones D and E. For any clone D, D sub K will denote the set of K, I remember. So D to the card A to the K minus 1 is going to be actually a, let's suppose these both contain the clone of C. Therefore, all the operations of the algebra A will be in the clone, and therefore this is going to be a subalgebra of A raised to the, A to the A to the card A to the K minus 1 here. So, big exponent, right? And likewise, E, I should just put a variable subscript here. So this is the clone of Blois area, the subset of Blois area operations in the two clones. Those are two subalgebras of this guy. If they're equal, well, let's just say if C size A to the K minus 1 equals D size A to the K minus 1, then it will be true that for all positive integers S and for all Y contained in A to the S, of size less or equal k minus 1, we will have that the projections of these two clones, CS and DS and ES, into A to the Y are equal. In order to ensure that the algebra of S area operations in D and the algebra of S area operations in E give you the same functions restricted to subsets of A to the S of at most K minus 1 elements, which is what this is saying, All you need to require is that, for all s, is that at this level, size a to the k minus 1, the guys are equal. It should be, yes, thank you. And if you think about it, you can see why this is true. If you've got a k minus 1 tuple of elements of a to the s, you really have a function from S into A to the K minus 1, and that has at most size A to the K minus 1 at many equivalence classes, so you can identify variables on those equivalence classes and reduce your operation you're looking at, which is projecting in a certain way at those places, you reduce it to a function which is a sequence, which is essentially only has a to the k minus 1 variables, and although it has a lot of dummy variables, and it projects the same way into a to the y, right? So that's an exercise. But what this means is, look, we've got c1 of let me take p equals size a to the k minus 1. The set of PRE members of C1 contains the set of PRE members of C2, and so forth. It's a descending chain. These guys are all inside A to the P, which is a finite set. So essentially, eventually they have to be constant. So there exists a K2 such that for all L and L prime greater than or equal to K2, the clones CL and CL prime have the same PRE members. And this applies from the lemma that for every S, when you restrict the clone CL sub S to a set of S tuples, at most K minus 1 of them, you get exactly the same functions as you do from CL prime. Okay, so one of the two conditions of the big theorem is true. For the clone CS, which contains CS prime, they project to sets of at most k minus 1 arguments the same way. And now we just have to deal with indices. So that's the harder part. So how do you deal with indices? So it's this part of this theorem that gets at. Well, I want to define if A, B are in A, C in A, B is the set of all alpha and W such that alpha A, B, now this is an index, is witnessed in the clone C in at what level? Well, alpha is going to be a k-tuple, a word of length k. It's ck, where k is the length of alpha. So this is the clone cn gives rise to a whole bunch of algebras. Cn sub s is a subalgebra of a to the a to the s, okay? The Oh, you're right. I did this when I was writing up the paper, too, so let me stay away from K. This has nothing to do with K. Alpha can be any word, so it's an element of A to the M for some M, and then this is the M-ary members of clone CN, and alpha is one of a member of the exponent, so alpha AB is a legitimate index. Recall that we're ordering A to the M lexicographically. So we can talk about witnesses, and I'm saying that this thing is actually witnessed in CNM, in that algebra. It's a subalgebra of A raised to the A to the N. Because the clause C contains C, sub N contains C, this will be a subalgebra of that algebra. So it turns out, and this is really, I think, the key, the heart of the argument, that all these things, C, N, A, B, every one of them is a down set in the ordered set. W under press equal. And moreover, for a fixed AB, of course we have C1AB. Just look at the definition. It contains C2AB because clone C1 contains clone C2. So we're getting smaller subalgebras of A to the M for every M. So we've got a decreasing sequence of downsets in this quasi-well-ordered set, and they have to be eventually constant. So there's got to exist, oh, I don't know. Did I use a K2 over here somewhere? I did. I'm going to use L2. There's got to exist L1. Let me call it LAB, such that whenever L and L prime are greater than or equal to LAB, then this was supposed to be W, excuse me. In the notes, you'll probably see W, WNAB. That makes more sense. So WLAB equals WLL'AB. Now, there's only five many possibilities for AB, so we can take the max of all these LABs and max that with the L2 over here. Let me just say that suppose we have L and L prime. L prime is greater than L, greater than the max of all the, what I call it, LAB, union L2. It's going to follow from this theorem that clone CL is equal to clone CL prime. Because for every S, at the S level, the algebra C super L sub S contained in A to the A to the S, and the corresponding algebra for L prime, this is like the R and the S here. It's a nested pair of algebras that witness exactly the same splittings and have the same projections to subsets of the exponent of at most K minus 1 elements. And that was the end of that proof. I like the proof. It's not so hard, but it required to put together the whole idea of Graham-Higmans with some ideas that the idea of indices and getting these small subalgebras generating algebras and relations, small subsets generating algebras and relations, that came out of CSP theory. Yeah. As I suspected, I don't know how much time I've actually got left, but my watch says can't be much more than, my watch is fast, I don't know for sure, but what?
10 more minutes.
Yeah, that's good, 10 minutes. Yeah, I can do a lot in 10 minutes. Huh? Sure. Okay, so that takes me where? That takes me up to page 7 of this write-up, actually. There's only 3 more pages. So now I'm going to describe some special clones and claim that an idempotent clone has a cube term if and only if it is contained in none of these. These guys are going to turn out to be, this, for a given set A, they are finite in number. They will be exactly the maximal idempotent clones that do not contain a cube term, and they will also be exactly the maximal clones that are not finite related. The maximal subclones of the clone of idempotent operations that have the non-finitely related property. There's finitely many of those, and they for each one, they're so special that the membership problem for each clone is computable. You can take an operation and compute whether it belongs to the clone in polynomial time very easily. The number of these clones is on the order of 2 to the card A. So if you let A be a variable in this construction, then the algorithm that you get to decide whether finitely many idempotent operations generate a cube operation is not, it's exponential time, but for a fixed set, it's polynomial time. So I want to describe these clones, and the rest of the talk is somehow about how you prove that a clone is an idempotent clone has a cube operation, if and only if it's contained in no one of these guys. It's done in the talk notes. If you can actually work a couple of easy exercises, you can do it. So A is, again, a finite set. And we're looking at pairs D contained in and not equal to S, contained in A, non-empty sets. Pairs DS of nested non-empty subsets of A. And then I define relations RNDS. This is just S to the N, take away S minus D to the N. So all the N tuples of elements of S that have at least one occurrence of D, for N equals 1, this is just D. And C sub DS, I should put a sub A here, but I'm going to leave it out. This is the intersection over such pairs, over N of the opposite clone of RNDS. And I think I also need to add S itself as a relation. So all the operations that respect all of these relations and as well as, because I, thinking about it again, I don't think that operations that respect all of these must respect S, but S and D should be subalgebras for these operations. I is all the idempotent operations on A, and I'll define C sub I of DS to be C DS intersect I. And I'm going to, the clones that I've been talking about are exactly these. Yes. It's in the Galois connection here. So these are all, this is all the relation, all the operations that respect this relation. That respect all these relations. S and every RNDS. So the big claim, which is proved, is that these guys are all non-comparable. CIDS contained in CI D prime S prime implies D equals D prime S equals S prime. This is easy. Idempotent. You can remove the idempotent. It's also true. I mean, if this is true, then it's not. It's going to be true without the I. The collection of these clones, CIDS over all DS, is exactly the maximal members of 1 clones contained in I without cube term, cube operation, It's also the family of maximal idempotent clones that are not finitely related. Clones contained in I, not finitely related. Now, the fact that, CI is not finitely related is easy. If it were finitely related, it's generated by a finite set of relations, since the generation of relations in relational clones is finitary. You're talking about positive primitive definitions or whatever you like. That would mean that some finitely many of these relations define the whole clone. But I can construct an idempotent operation that respects R1 to Rn and S and doesn't respect Rn plus 1. Just let g of an n plus 1 tuple equal g of a0 to an equals a0 if at most one of the entries belongs to D. If two of them belong to D, then choose ai where I is the least, so that ai belongs to D. And that'll be n plus 1 array, and it doesn't respect Rn plus 1. It's certainly idempotent, doesn't respect Rn plus 1, because if you take a member of S minus D for A1 to An, and a member of D for A0, well, G of the result ought to belong to D, excuse me, I'll take the member of D to be, say, A1, all the other guys to be one fixed guy outside of D, so G of that input is the member outside of D, it shouldn't be. But if you feed in n tuples that belong to Rn, for instance, and you look at what happens, each of those tuples has a d somewhere, and two of the tuples have to have the d in the same place. So one of your rows is going to, the definition is going to tell you at that row g is giving you a member d. So, okay, so these are not finitely related. They are incomparable. The theorem says that a finite idempotent algebra has a cube term if and only if its clone is contained in none of these. A consequence of that is that these are the maximal clones that don't have a cube term. And combined with the other theorem that if you have a cube term, you're finitely related. So algebras with a cube term are inherently finitely related. Every larger clone is finitely related. So these are exactly the largest clones that are not finitely related. The largest idempotent clones. Now, if you allow non-idempotent operations, everything gets sort of fuzzy and hard to understand what's going on. And I'm done. Thank you. Ask me about Valerius conjecture. Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, you just, whatever the set A is in the given operations. Well, if you're feeding in idempotent operations, otherwise there's a problem. If you have some finite many operations, how do you compute the idempotent clone generation? How do you get your hands on the idempotent clone? This proof doesn't work unless the operations are idempotent. Yeah, well, you could reformulate Matt's conjecture. In the paper that I wrote with Miklos and Peter, we did it one way, using Liebhardt's result in commutator theory. You can show that Matt's conjecture is equivalent to saying that if you have a finite-related finite algebra with day terms, then and you take any subalgebra B of A squared and any homomorphic image of B, and then you add all the constants to get a larger clone, that algebra is finitely related. So finite relatedness is, in the presence of day terms, is preserved under a few constructions. And there's all kinds of variations of that. That's equivalent to Valerius conjecture. The other thing is, something I've been working on off and on without formulating it too carefully, is you can make an equivalent that just involves the use of relations Rn. See, how does it go? given any single, given any finitely many relations on a finite set that are respected by day terms, there's got, and given any pair of DS of subalgebras, there's got to be an N such that that relation RNDS is not generated by the given relations. It doesn't have a PP definition. For large N, RNDS does not have a PP definition in terms of these fixed relations, provided that the relations are respected by day terms. Okay, so that gives you something that looks like CSP problems to explore, PP definitions at least. It's a funny property, but that's it. And I haven't been able to make any progress looking at it in that way. Seems hard, just as hard as it did before.